good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for allowing myself and my colleague Christine to come and speak to you again. We are both solicitors with Batten's. Christine's actually based in our Dorchester office. I'm based in our Wareham office. And I please contain your shock because of our youthful appearances. But between us, we have over 25 years' experience. We've got many years of advising clients on wills, powers of attorney, and inheritance tax. So Christine is going to talk about why you should make a will, what you need to consider when you're making one, or if you've even already made one. And she'll be focusing on executors, and I know the thing everyone's most interested in, inheritance tax. We're leaving that little gem to the very end. I will start by talking about powers of attorney. So you'll find all legal advisors, we always drop the phrase powers of attorney, but what we're really, or what we really mean, is something called a lasting power of attorney, or an LPA. I just want to mention, there is an important distinction that many clients quite innocently make a confusion of. Your LPA only covers matters in your lifetime. When you die, your LPA dies with you, and the authority to handle your affairs on your death passes to your executors in your will. Even if they're the same person, they are going to be changing their hat. So some people say, oh, I've got it all sorted out, and they're actually thinking about their will. So if we're talking about your lifetime and your LPA. If any of you have heard me talk about LPAs before, you'll probably know that I make the analogy between LPAs and insurance. Every single one of us here has taken out insurance, be that car insurance, health insurance, house insurance, or travel insurance. And we do that in the hope that we're never going to have to claim on it. And so we're paying for something we might not be using. And there is a similar risk with an LPA. You're paying for a document you may never need to use, but if the time came when you needed one and you haven't got one in place, the costs and the difficulties for your family can prove to be prohibitive. I want to make a very brief comment about enduring powers of attorney, or EPAs. EPAs were the forerunners to LPAs, more specifically property and financial affairs LPAs. You could make EPAs up until September 2007. So if any of you are sat there thinking, I think I did do a power of attorney thing, but it was probably 20, 25 years ago. The chances are it could well be an EPA. But the important thing to remember with EPAs is that while you can no longer make one, they are still valid and can still be used. So if you think that's what you've got in place and you're not sure whether it's still fit for what you require it to do, ask, get advice on it, because you may well find it's still exactly what you need and you don't have to make a property and financial affairs LPA. So LPAs were introduced in October 2007. So from that point onwards, all you've ever been able to make is an LPA. And they gave us something new. Not only could you appoint somebody to handle your property and finances, so basically replacing the EPA, you could now appoint attorneys to cover your health and welfare, which was something you've never been able to do before. Another big change with LPAs is that they have to be registered before they can be used. So the registration of an LPA does not mean you've lost capacity. Many clients worry about that. It just means it's there and it's ready to be used if it needs to be used. They've always hinted that they might merge the health and welfare lasting power of attorney and the property and financial affairs lasting power of attorney. But that has not yet happened. They are still two separate documents. So as many people might say, well, it means solicitors can charge twice for them. But yeah, who am I to comment on that? But when you're making an LPA, you need to think very importantly about your attorneys. You can have as many attorneys as you want, but you'll find most people will advise not more than four. You must trust your attorneys. Not only that they're not going to misuse your money, that run off to Bognor or Benidorm or Bermuda, depending on how much money you've got, but the main thing is that they act in your best interests. And when we talk about best interests, what we mean is that they do what is best for you, not what is the easiest or most convenient outcome for them. And another real important thing is when you're choosing your attorneys, you're thinking, do I trust that person? You've also got to think, do my attorneys trust each other? Will they communicate with each other? Because if you have any concerns regarding that, you could potentially be storing up problems for the future. Sadly, for many solicitors, sometimes what we're finding is we've got families that are falling out that have been appointed under the same LPA. Another important person in a lasting power of attorney is a certificate provider, who is a person that confirms in their opinion the person making the LPA has the capacity to do so and hasn't been forced to do it. If you've got a solicitor or a legal professional making your LPA, they can be your certificate provider. But if you are making the LPA yourself, you might consider asking your friend, because if someone's known you for 2 years, they can be your certificate provider. I always say, think carefully who you ask, or in turn, if you are asked by a friend. Because if there is any doubt as to capacity, I think it's important you get a professional involved. Because if the LPA is then challenged further down the line due to potential lack of capacity or influence, it's the certificate provider who's potentially in the firing line. GPs may or may not do the certificate for you. As a professional that sometimes asks doctors, it can vary. I have some GPs are more than happy. Other GP practices will have a carte blanche rule that they just don't do them. So when I've given talks before, I've often focused on the property and financial affairs LPA. But today I want to speak a little bit more about a health and welfare LPA. There's always been a larger take-up of the property and financial affairs LPA, because there's, even me as a professional advisor, there's a clearer need for it. If you lose your capacity and you haven't got an LPA or an EPA in place, your family won't have any access to your finances. And what they'll be faced with is a lengthy, costly, and bureaucratic application to the court to be appointed a deputy. And then, once a deputy is appointed, the court's involvement does not end, and there's usually annual court fees to pay, a report to complete each year, and in that report, you have to account for every penny you are spending as the deputy for the person. And I've not come across anyone yet who is pleased that they've had to do a deputyship application for a family member. So in contrast, if you lose your capacity and health and welfare decisions have to be made, even without an LPA, decisions can still be made for you. But I would say, as a professional in this area, over the last few years, I am really noticing a change. Because I'm increasingly finding that care homes, care sector professionals, doctors, healthcare professionals are frequently asking if health and welfare LPAs are in place, especially for recent care home admissions, and also for clients who may have diagnoses of Alzheimer's or dementia, even in that very, very early stage. So why are they asking this? And I will be honest, this is something I never truly appreciated. And I have a friend who works in the care home sector. And they give me a very simple example of having somebody in their home who needs rails on their bed because they're falling out of bed. If that person's got capacity, you can ask them, are you happy for us to put rails on your bed? If that person doesn't have capacity and they haven't got a power of attorney in place, a lasting power of attorney in place, they would have to conduct a best interests assessment to see whether or not it's in the person's interest to fit the rails on that person's bed. However, if that person has a health and welfare lasting power of attorney, maybe appointing their son or their daughter, the home could ask the family if they are happy for that to be the rails to be put on the bed. It's a small thing, but I can see how it can make their life easier. Also, if you think about medical decisions, so let's think about somebody who does have dementia and they require a medical procedure, and I'm not even talking about a life-saving medical procedure, it can be something quite straightforward. They may not have the capacity to consent to the treatment they need. And whilst physicians should always consult with family and those interested in welfare, the decision, again, would relate back to being, is it in their best interest to have this operation? And you might sit there and go, well, actually, I'm quite happy for my doctors to have the final say. But there are some situations you might need to think about. You may actually want those decisions to be made by your loved ones, immediate family. You may actually be cohabiting with a partner, and you may not be married or in a civil partnership, but you want that partner to be able to make decisions for you. Also, and very sadly, for family members to be estranged, and you may only wish for certain family members to make certain decisions for you. You may not have any close family, you just might have cousins that live in Wales or Scotland who you're not close to, but you may have friends or other people that you've grown up around that you trust far more implicitly. A health and welfare LPA gives you the ability to give someone that authority. And if you're making both types of LPA, you do have the ability to have different attorneys for different things. So you may have a child or a friend that's a healthcare professional, and you think they would be perfect for a health and welfare LPA, but they might get a bit anxious or worried if they had to make decisions about your money. Conversely, you might have somebody who you know would feel completely at ease with the responsibility of handling your money, but if you were suddenly going to ask them to make decisions about whether or not you go into a care home, they just might not know where to start. So you can have those different people, but it then comes back to the idea that you want those people to be able to communicate and get on with one another. If you said, oh yes, Steve would be great for my finances, Bob would be great for my health and welfare, I would ask, do Bob and Steve get on? No, they hate each other. They don't like talking to each other. You are potentially storing up a problem for the future. So, if you've got an EPA, that is still valid and may still be fine. And even if you've just got a property and financial affairs LPA, that's great. But it might be worth considering making a health and welfare LPA. When it comes to making a lasting power of attorney, you can do it through a solicitor or legal professional, and we're always best, we are there to advise on how you appoint your attorneys, any guidance you might want to include, but you can also make them yourself. There are always various things you can find online. Generally, I would always point people in the direction of the .gov website. That's the best way to go if you didn't want to go through a solicitor. I could talk about lasting powers of attorney and their various associated considerations for a long time, but I'm pretty sure you'd start to all question your own capacity by the end of that. So I'm now going to go on to the cheery topic of wills and inheritance tax, so which I'll hand over to my colleague Christine.
Thank you very much. I'm going to talk briefly about wills. I'm going to focus at the end on the choice of executors, because that's an issue that seems to be coming up more and more. And I'm also going to give you an update on inheritance tax rules. So start with the basic question, why on earth make a will? A will is a legal declaration of who is going to inherit your assets after you die. So the question is, why would you make one when, frankly, you are not going to be benefiting or from this in any way or knowing anything about it? The first reason you usually do it is consideration to your family. And if any of you have had to deal with an estate where someone hasn't left a will, then that's quite often the prompt for sorting out your own will and sorting out your own financial affairs. Second reason for making a will is usually for your own peace of mind, because it's the only way you are going to ensure that your assets go to the people that you choose. So if you don't have a will, your estate on your death will be governed by what's called the intestacy rules, which I'm not going to go through in detail, but basically your assets may not end up where you want them to go. So what's in a will? Usually the first appointment is your choice of executors. So who is going to administer your estate? So they deal with the sort of financial and legal things, filling out the forms, applying for a grant of probate, but they also deal with the personal things, such as sorting out your personal possessions. I'm going to come back a bit to executors in a minute. You can include funeral wishes in a will. I've got to be honest, they are not legally binding, but people sometimes want to see them in a will. If you feel strongly about them, it is more important that you tell your family, tell the people that are going to be making those decisions. Quite often, we advise that people, if people have got detailed funeral wishes, you do it in a separate letter rather than putting it in your will, because then you can change that letter as much as you like over your life without having to change your will. Wills can include the appointment of guardians, so if you have responsibility for young children, you can legally appoint someone else to look after them in the event of your death. But the main bit of your will is choosing who gets what. So it's gifts to families, to friends, to charities, whoever you choose. You can leave your money wherever you like. And it can be fixed amounts of money, like I leave £1,000 to the dog's home or to this person, or it can be percentages, which is usually the most flexible way to do it. Most wills are usually a sort of combination of both. So that's the basics of what's in your will. So inheritance tax. What are the rules and how does it affect your will? In short, inheritance tax is unlikely to actually affect the wording of your will. There is nothing magic we can do in a will that stops you having to pay inheritance tax if your estates are subject to inheritance tax. In fact, the rules at the moment generally mean that the simpler the will, the better. But what are the actual rules themselves? I'm going to look at two scenarios. I'm going to look at what the inheritance tax, the IHT, rules are during your lifetime. And then I'm going to look at what the rules are on your death. So you do need to be aware of them during your lifetime as well as for your estates on your death. So during your lifetime, you can give away as much as you like during your lifetime to individuals, and there is no immediate charge to IHT, to inheritance tax. There is no gift tax as such in this country. But there are some rules. If you give away assets and you die within 7 years, then that gift is included in your estate for inheritance tax purposes. But the result of this is just usually to use up a bit of what's called your nil rate band. Every individual has a nil rate band, which is currently £325,000 free of inheritance tax on your death. So if you've made gifts in the previous 7 years that are under that amount, all it does is just use up a bit of that allowance. It doesn't mean that there is tax to pay. If you made gifts in the last 7 years before your death that exceeded the £325,000, then they could be subject to inheritance tax. And indeed, there's a tapering rate of inheritance tax if you survive more than 3 years from making the gift. But if your estate is not subject to inheritance tax, and I'm going to give you all the figures in a minute so you can work it out, you basically don't need to worry about the seven-year rule. You are free to make the gifts that you want to make. There's some small inheritance tax allowances that are worth bearing in mind just for your sort of planning. You can give away £3,000 a year. It's called your annual allowance, plus £250 to as many individuals as you like. So say you've got three kids, you might give them £1,000 each a year and the grandchildren £250 each. That can all be done without the seven-year rule being relevant. And there's various gifts on marriages you can make as well without the seven-year rule being relevant. So other than the seven-year rule, the next main rule to just bear in mind if you are making gifts in your lifetime is what I call no strings attached. So if you make a gift, it's got to be an outright gift with no conditions or strings attached, because otherwise it falls foul of something called the gift with reservation of benefit rules. And basically, even though you've given something away, your seven-year clock does not start ticking. The classic example of that is if you legally put your house into the names of your kids, but you stayed living in it. You've legally given it away and it's no longer yours, but on your death, the tax man is still going to say that house is in your estate because the seven-year clock has not started ticking. The last rule, I would say, around, or just thing to be aware of with lifetime gifts and inheritance tax, is if you give away cash, that is the simplest way, and there are no tax implications to that, and you certainly don't have to worry about capital gains tax, CGT. But if you gave away, say, a property or some shares to a child, to any individual, then capital gains tax could be relevant. Because even if you give away assets for nothing, it is deemed to be a transfer at market value, so it could trigger capital gains tax. So an example could be you've got a rental property, you no longer need it, you decide you're going to transfer it to your children. Should you have bought it for, say, $100,000, but now it's worth $200,000, that is a substantial gain. So if you make that gift, it could trigger capital gains tax at either 18 or 28%. So just watch out for that. During your lifetime, you just need to be aware of the 7-year rule, the sort of no strings attached rule, and just be wary that make sure you don't trigger capital gains tax. So now looking at the second scenario, what happens on your death with inheritance tax? Any gifts you leave to a spouse or registered civil partner or to charity are free of inheritance tax, without limit. Otherwise, as I've mentioned, every individual has a nil rate band of £325,000 free of inheritance tax. And then when inheritance tax does kick in above that, it is charged at 40%. But if you're married and you leave everything to each other, then on the second death, you have two lots of nil rate band because the nil rate band transfers from one spouse to another. So a married couple that leaves everything to each other on the second death, when, say, it then goes to children, we've got £650,000 free of inheritance tax. So basically, if your estates, if you're a married couple and your estates are under the £650,000, just don't worry about inheritance tax. Don't worry about the 7-year rule. It's just not relevant for you. A few years ago, some more inheritance tax exemptions came in, which actually make the allowances quite a bit more generous. An additional allowance of £150,000, which is actually going up to £175,000 in the next tax year, is for individuals who own their own home and leave it to what's called lineal descendants. That's effectively children or grandchildren. It's called the residential nil rate band. And like the nil rate band, it can be transferred from one spouse to another on death. So for a married couple who own their own home, they're leaving everything to each other and at the end of the day to the children. If you add up all these exemptions, so the two lots of nil rate bands, £650,000, your two lots of residential nil rate bands, effectively you've got £950,000 free of inheritance tax going up to £1 million from this tax year. So the allowances for inheritance tax are far more generous than they have ever been. So mainly it's good news for people who own their own houses and have children. If you are in the bracket of your assets being above the nil rate band, so for an individual 325, for a couple 650,000, and you think you're going to need the residential nil rate band to get your estate out of paying tax, it is worth reviewing your will. And the reason for that is the complexity of the legislation that brought in the residential nil rate band means that we've had to amend the drafting of certain clauses to make sure that executors can claim it. So that would be a reason, if you think you're going to need the residential nil rate band, get a professional to have a look at your will and make sure it's going to do the job. The rules around the new residential nil rate band are ludicrously complicated, and we hate it, I think is the bottom line. They were rushed in, and they were not particularly well thought out. And they've already gone through one review, and for some unknown reason, they've decided, let's just leave it a bit longer and see how they work out. But it was quickly pointed out, for example, that with these new rules, it could put people off selling a property when actually it's probably in their best interest to do so. For example, an elderly person that needs to pay for their care. And this is also in a country which has a housing shortfall. So what was quickly introduced after the rules were announced was something called the downsizing provisions. So if at the time of your death you've previously sold your house, your executors can still claim the residential nil rate band because you've previously owned a property, as long as the downsizing or selling of that property took place after the 8th of July 2015. So that's how they've got round the, you don't hold on to your house for tax purposes. Just a couple other points concerning the residential nil rate band in case they are relevant for your situation. The definition of lineal descendants, again, is ludicrously complicated, and it shouldn't be. It doesn't just mean children or grandchildren. It can mean stepchild, adopted child, foster child, and indeed all their lineal descendants and bizarrely spouses. But it doesn't mean nephews and nieces and siblings, which I think we all think is just grossly unfair. So if you're married, but you don't have children and you want to leave everything to your nephews and nieces, the residential nil rate band is not available to your estate. The other thing to just bear in mind, I don't know if this is going to be relevant for anyone, but if you have estates over 2.2 million, then you can't get the residential nil rate band. And indeed, if you have estates between 2 million and 2.2 million, there's a sort of tapering rate as you lose that allowance. So for the real higher net worth individuals, this new allowance is not available. Right, you're all looking alarmed. What do I need to do? Nothing. Don't worry is basically it's my answer to that. Because, as I said, inheritance tax allowances have never been this generous. So loads of estates are out of the inheritance tax threshold these days. It is worth reviewing your will, certainly in light of the new residential nil rate band. If you decide to make any gifts, there's no formal way to do this really, but just keep really good records, because your executors will be asked, what gifts did so-and-so make in the last 7 years? And rather than pay someone like me to go through your bank statements, if there's a nice little note that says, this is what I did, even if it's, I used my annual exemption this year, signed the end of the tax year, that is incredibly helpful to your executors. So just keep good records, ideally with your paperwork, copies of your will. Also, because of these new downsizing provisions, if you do sell a property, keep a record of that. And it's literally, the solicitor at the end gives you a completion statement that shows about the sale of the property. That's the piece of paper, again, put in the envelope with your copy of your will, because that can be really, really useful to your executors. So bottom line is, don't worry, but just try and be organised and just keep some good records. So lastly, I'm just going to go back to wills, really, and choice of executors. And the reason for that is, well, I was asked to write a recent article and I had to think about what went wrong most often with estates. And it is, I think we both agree here, fallings out between executors. And it seems to be becoming more and more of an issue these days. And I think that's because estates are generally worth more these days, properties are worth more, but also people have more complicated family setups. The disputes I've had to deal with recently have generally been centred on property and the sale price of a property and executors not agreeing on what they're going to put the property on the market for or what offer they are going to accept, and there is then a falling out and things grind to a halt. Just a quick mention, executors and beneficiaries, so the people that benefit from your will, can be the same people. There seems to be a bit of a myth that you have to have someone independent, and that's not the case. And 9 times out of 10, it makes sense for a beneficiary to also be an executor, because being an executor is a really onerous job. So think really carefully if any of your friends ever ask you. It's a lot of work to do. So if you're a beneficiary as well, you're sorting it out in your own interest. So say, for instance, you've got 3 kids and you're leaving everything equally between them. You could appoint the 3 of them as executors and they'll just get on with doing the job, and it's in their own interests. The things to bear in mind is that executors have to act unanimously. So not by majority. So this is why I'm sort of using the three kids example. Because if one doesn't wish to cooperate, everything just grinds to a halt. Just because the other two agree on what to do, if that one doesn't, then there is not a lot the other ones can do. Also, if, say, those 3 executors have appointed a solicitor to deal with things for them, and they then fall out, 2 want to do something, 1 wants to do something else, Natalie here can no longer act for any of them. She just has to stop and wait for them to sort out their individual problems. So what that means is she can't advise any of them individually. She only advises them collectively as executors. So if one of them wants to do something and the others want to do something else, they're all going to have to go and take their own legal advice. Natalie sits there while they just argue it out, and then she can keep acting, assuming they can sort it out. So basically that means it costs a fortune, because you're paying for the solicitor that's acting for the executors, and you're paying for solicitors to advise the individuals as well. So it can take months. I mean, things really do. I've had property sales just completely fall through because it just all grinds to a halt. It is possible for beneficiaries of a will, or indeed co-executors, to apply to court to get an executor removed. So that there is an option, there is a mechanism to sort this out. But again, it costs lots of money and it takes a lot of time. So anything you can do to sort of troubleshoot and make sure this doesn't happen is a really good thing. Who you choose as executors is really, really important. It's about, do they get on? Will they get on with the job in hand? And you have to think about those individuals and how they get on, but also influence of other halves, you know, on the dynamic. So really think carefully about your choice of executors. If you don't think the family is going to be able to do it, or there are issues, etc., you can get a professional to act as an executor. And they can either act by themselves, so you can have like the directors of a firm or your accountant, or they could act alongside, so you have maybe a family member and you have a professional. So there's lots of different options, but just the experience we've been having over the last few years of things just grinding to a halt, because neither of us deal with things when they grind to, you know, when it gets contested and people start wanting to go to court, we hand that over to our very expensive colleagues in the litigation department while we sit there and wait for people to sort it out, and then we'll get on with the probate. But so anything you can do to, you know, troubleshoot and stop that kind of dispute happening in your estate is a really good thing.